Welcome to Inside the Artist. My name is Rachel Corman. Welcome to the show. I took a few months off because I was working on a TV show, and I'm so excited to be back doing this and bringing amazing, awesome, creative people here to talk to about their journeys, about how they got there, and I hope you, the listeners, feel inspired to go after any dreams and artistic goals that you may have. Today, my guest is the amazing Frankie Shaw. She is the creator, producer, writer, star, played every role on Smilf, which if you haven't seen it, it's an incredible show. It's changing the game of television. And Frankie, I have to say, is one of the hardest working people in show business now. You know, now she is staffing the writer's room to get ready for season 2. We obviously talk about Smilf, but we also talk about her acting background and her writing background and how she got to where she is now and how she created the show. Here is my interview with Frankie Shaw. Enjoy. You are my season 2 premiere.
Oh, it's such an honor.
I can't think of a better guest to have.
Thank you.
We just wrapped on season 1 of Smilf.
Yep.
And how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm right now meeting writers for season 2. So we're deep in it. It's sort of like speed dating.
How many writers do you meet with at a time?
I mean, normally about maybe 7 or 8 or a day. And we've been doing it for almost 2 weeks now. So we've met a lot of people.
And how do you feel about the pool so far?
It's great. I mean, everyone is so different and talented. It's just trying to figure out who, what is needed in the room, like what deficiencies or whatever that we have that we don't, like what other support besides the writers are already in there, you know? So it's like casting a show. It's like, you know, cause they're all great. Just see who fits in where.
Well, what I really touch on this show is the idea to manifest a dream. Mm-hmm. And what I think is so great about you, I just think you are a shining example of someone who has done that. You know, you've been through a lot of struggle in your life that mm-hmm. you've talked about, and now you have your own television show on Showtime.
Yes.
And tell me about how that feels and how you got there.
I feel really lucky. I feel, it is a wild dream. You know, it's almost unbelievable. I mean, when it was first happening, I would keep telling my husband, like, remember when I lived in a tiny room? Remember when I couldn't afford gas? Like, remember when it was all just sort of seemed so far out of reach? And now we're doing it. And, yeah, it's so I feel really lucky. I feel also that maybe I was always working towards this, but I don't know, a lot of people work towards a goal or have, you know, ideas that they're not able to pursue or don't have the opportunity. So, yeah, I don't know, it's really exciting and I almost can't believe it, but then also it feels so normal at the same time.
Well, you're so deserving of it because you work your ass off. I mean, I've seen it working on Smilf with you, how hard you work. Mm-hmm. And I can see that that has been your journey as you've been writing, you know, mm-hmm. that you are such a hard worker and you're so motivated. And
but I am a hard worker. So when I get the opportunity to work, I'll work really hard. But I think it... You also have to say that it's not the only thing, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's so many people who work hard and aren't given an opportunity. So it's we have to acknowledge the like privilege I have to be given this opportunity.
So you think part of it is luck too?
It's not, well, it's like, well, I mean, I don't know if like luck is the exact right term, but you know, I was able to get a really good education. I can, my acting experience has given me the ability to speak in a room of executives. You mm-hmm. know, it's a lot of things that all led up to this, you know. I mean, part of it is just, like, I've been reading a lot, like, part of my, like, white girl privilege. So mm-hmm. that, like, yeah. I have the education, the opportunity, the thing that people can, you know, something that feels trustworthy, you know, to give millions of dollars to go create a show. And I'm not saying it's like always been like this, or I could have made this show 10 years ago because I couldn't have, you know, mm-hmm. but yeah, I am very hardworking and love this job and feel capable. But I also am lucky to be in this circumstance that I'm in, position that I'm in.
Why is it, do you think, that you never gave up? Because you easily could have moved back to Boston, quit acting, you know, especially after having Isaac. I'm sure that was more challenging to pursue acting.
I think there's something about not ever having, like, a cushion that, it's a survival mechanism. So, you know, I had to keep going because that sort of seemed like the only option. It wasn't like I could have gone back to Boston and got some office job or something. But even still, like, I don't know how I didn't. This was like the only thing that, like, I really feel like I knew that I could do. I would probably be fired at an office job within like 5 minutes. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's like the thing, like, I remember just going when Isaac was little, going on auditions and being like, well, I have to figure out how to survive for us. So there was like a drive because of that. And also there's just a drive when you maybe grow up the way I didn't have any pressure to succeed, but I also didn't have, it's not like I had parents who were pressuring me to be anything. And so I was sort of like afloat and adrift in a way that allowed me to sort of find this internal motivation, which I don't know why. Like, I have it. And mm-hmm. some people don't have it. And my aunt who lives in Southie, who has a high school education, but she just like is so happy and doesn't, in her life, and doesn't have this sort of thing of like, you keep going. Like, what's bigger? What's next? You know, like that kind of thing. So I don't know. I don't know. It's a personality, a survival. Yeah. So, yeah. I don't know.
No, I definitely can relate to that. Has writing and directing always been a dream, or was acting primarily always at the forefront?
I mean, I got to college when I was 18 and hadn't been exposed to anything in the arts. So I had like secret dreams when I would see a school play. Like, oh, it would be so fun to do that. And I would like goof around with my friends in elementary school. I mean, I still remember my friend, Sasha Lambert, like fake crying and like doing this whole bit for her. And she's like, you should be an actress. And I was like, I know. But like, it never was like a thing.
Like, I want to pursue that.
Yeah, I didn't know how to do it. Uh-huh. I mean, no one, in this sort of way that I was saying that I was adrift, I never had a parent or any sort of guidance of like, this is how you get a job or pursue a career or be an adult. It was just sort of like, I had this idea of like a classy woman who lived in Beacon Hill, sort of like I had an aunt like this and have an aunt like this. And I was like, I just want to be classy. I want to figure out how to be classy. That was like my dream, which is so not who I am. It's so funny. And then when I got to college, it was New York City, and like by chance ended up taking a photography class. And
what'd you go to school for?
I studied English Lit and then started taking acting class and photography class there and was so drawn to it. You know, was overwhelmed by the art I was exposed to, and was like, oh, this is just being around it felt exciting. You know, I didn't know even then, didn't know how to pursue it. And then I got an internship at an agency at Gersh in New York. I think it was my senior year of college, and was like, stole the breakdowns, the password, you know, and started self-submitting. Because then it became like an athletic goal.
Mm.
So then it became like this challenge, can I get an agent?
So you thought by hacking in, that's how you get an agent?
Yeah. You're just good at all costs.
Did you just email every agent that you found?
Well, so it was the breakdowns for every project that was casting. So I would then take my headshot and mail it or drop it underneath the door to the casting office. And I got my first job that way.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I had a similar thing when I moved here. I actually looked up production numbers to every TV show that was filming in Los Angeles.
Wow.
I made a spreadsheet. And I cold called each of them.
Wow.
And that's actually how I got my first PA job.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
See, it works.
It does.
Being relentless, annoying young person.
It does. I always think, you know, you have to take risks. I mean, it's a balance. It's
right.
A, you know, you don't want to be over the top, you know, crossing boundaries. But I do think taking risks and asking for things is beneficial.
Yeah, for sure.
When did you get your first acting job?
So I went to Barnard in New York and was doing these short films. And for the film program at Columbia, they would all, like, all these thesis films I would sort of get cast in. And there was a film professor, an editing professor in the film school named Sloan. And she was editing a movie that was about to be cast. She was going to edit Morgan J. Freeman's next movie after he did Hurricane Streets, and he was making this movie just like The Sun. And they were trying to cast this girl. It was like a two-day part in North Carolina. And she saw me walking along the streets in the East Village. Uh-huh. And she called the director, was like, oh, there's this girl and she's in all of the shorts of all the students at the film school. I think she'd be right. So then the producer called me and had me come and audition, and I got the part. So that was my first role in a movie that was, it premiered at Tribeca and then never came out. and then around the same time, I had an agent who was like trying me out. Mm. And sent me on a Law and Order audition, and I booked that playing a waitress.
Because you were living in New York at the time.
Yeah.
So isn't Law and Order like the big thing you do
right
when you're in
passage.
New York?
Yeah, exactly. and that was in 2005, both those jobs. So those were both like the two. And then I did like little indies in New York for a while and then moved out to LA in 2007 at the end of seven when I got pregnant. And
was your intent when you moved to LA to act, or was it also to direct and write?
Well, when I was in college, I wrote a script and I harbored secret desires to direct. I just didn't know how it worked. So all of these indie movies that I did sort of served as my film school. So I think the desire was always there. And then actually, you know what? I made a few shorts that I never showed anybody along the way. And then put those away and didn't think about them and forgot about them. And then directed a few shorts the summer of 2014. And that's when I sort of started directing for real.
And when did you first write the Smilf pilot? Because it was a script before you made the short, which is a common misconception. People think that the short was made and then you sold the show.
Right. Well, I then sold the show, but it was always intended to be TV. So I started writing a version of the pilot, which was called,
it wasn't called Smilf initially?
No, there was one thing called Bringing Up Baby, and there was another thing called What to Expect. Two different titles I had over a few years. So I started writing in 2012, so long ago. And then that story was, I wrote this pilot, I was trying to get staffed as a TV writer, but then booked my first sitcom that paid me enough money to live, which was called Mixology, and that premiered in 2013, so I didn't have to staff as a TV writer. I was working as an actress. And then there was a producer who had read the script, and then we had a meeting, Michael Lenda, and he's like, oh, this is great, but your real stories are more interesting. Like, maybe you should infuse some of your real life into it. So then I started rewriting, and then from there, I was like, I still don't think people are going to get it. Let me go direct a scene from it. And that's how the short was birthed. And then we ended up selling it. So then I went to Sundance 2015, and then we sold it to Showtime the month later.
It's such an incredible story. It's amazing. Especially, like you say, you wrote it in 2012, and now in 2017, you're making the show.
Yeah.
And it premieres. I mean, in a matter of, was that 5 years?
Yeah. I mean, that's a long time.
It's definitely a long
time.
And it also shows that, you know, dreams can still happen. Like, don't give up. Just because it hasn't happened in your time frame, like, don't discourage yourself that, you know what I mean? It can still happen.
Right. I mean, I think that there's a couple of things, you know, there's definitely persistence. But there's also so many ideas about a story that maybe we'll tell or we'll write or we'll direct. And I think there's something valid that just because you have the idea doesn't mean it's the one. So it's like really figuring out within yourself, like, what is the worthy story? Like, why do you need to tell it?
Mm. So what is this for you?
I mean, there's such a deep struggle when I was, you know, a single mom to Isaac, but it was so comical. So there was that combination that, like, all these stories kept coming up. But then there's other themes in this, in the show, that I think would have come out, like, if I had made something about a married mom or just a group of friends. It's just sort of, like, maybe universal things that I needed to say and explore. But, yeah, definitely for me it was, like, focusing in on, like, non-traditional relationships and also having it be fully from, like, the female point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, like, raw and gritty if you're this person.
Right.
It's just real.
You're telling real stories, and I think that's why people are so connected to the show,
mm-hmm.
and why people are such big fans of it, because they're like, wait, that's me. I've experienced that. And that's something you don't really get a lot on TV.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of amazing shows, you know, out there now, and it's, I feel like obviously everyone is saying it's sort of like this Renaissance era. You know, it's like the most incredible time to be a TV creator, because you're allowed to sort of...
Like you say, you don't think you would have been able to sell this 5 years ago.
Totally. Yeah. Well,
especially the voice of a female voice is so prevalent right now. And I think the industry is giving women a lot more opportunities now.
For sure.
So I think you got really lucky in the time that you approached Showtime. Was it the first studio, or excuse me, first network that you approached?
Yeah. It was the first pitch.
First one, done!
I'm so spoiled in this experience, because Showtime is just creatively so supportive. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel really lucky and excited to keep making it and to keep making other things too.
What has the response been from real people in your life who the characters are based on?
Mm-hmm.
How have they responded to the show?
I mean, my family is, I mean, like the family in the show, but my family is, and very different as well, so proud, are fans of it. I think they're just, I mean, I think to them, I'm like this sort of quiet, they didn't even know that I was even like a writer or anything. Like, I don't know, they... So it was like, I think the whole thing was a surprise to them.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't. Yeah, so they're just
like, hey guys, now I write and direct and I have my own show on Showtime. Kind of, also, yeah, I star in it.
Totally.
They were like, what?
Yeah. I remember one of them said, like, I didn't know you were funny. And then, I mean, they're proud. They're excited. They are, my mom's happy that she doesn't have to worry about how I'm going to pay for, you know, my rent. And
you have more stability now.
Yeah. Yeah. So there, I mean, in terms of, like, you know, characters based off them, they know it's fictionalized and it's an extreme version. And I think they're just excited to pitch stories of other stuff that they've all experienced.
Isaac's even pitched stories, hasn't he?
Oh my God. Yeah. We have these writer meetings here, and then, so, you know, I'll be here maybe with Claire, my friend, who's coming on as a producer, and Scott King, and the last writer will leave, and we think Isaac's asleep in bed. He'll be like, I liked him. He was cool.
His feedback helps, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's valuable.
What did you learn most about showrunning?
It's the shittiest job you can have, because it's the most thankless, and no one even, I feel like, knows that I'm the showrunner. Like, I'll look at these lists online, like, top 25 female showrunners. Not that I have to be in the top, but I'm like, it's like such a, it's a really, really hard, thankless job, and you're making 5 million decisions.
You have to manage so many different departments.
Yeah.
And you are also so hands-on. You are involved in every single piece of the show.
Right. So I feel like it's not as if we had a different showrunner, it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if I didn't want to do it, because then I'd be doing it anyways because of my control issues.
It's your show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's your story. Of course you're going to be involved.
Right. And so I think it'll be great having Claire on the season to, you know, share some of the responsibility. And then, yeah, you know, it's hard. It was particularly hard with our crazy schedule. A first season of a show where a budget was made before a script was written. You know, it's just like, it was like, it was not easy, but it's also so gratifying because you do get to be in the middle of it all.
And you made it happen.
Yeah. And I mean, we had a good, an amazing group of people, and we all made it happen. But yeah, I don't know. This season we'll have more time. This season I'll delegate more, be able to delegate more. And I think the main thing about show running is protecting the time to be creative.
Mm.
You know, it's like really blocking out the hours where you're focusing only on writing. You know, at one point, Scott King, who's an EP writer on the show, when we were shooting, because I'm dealing with losing locations or, you know, VFX or whatever it is, mm-hmm. he's like, you have to turn your phone off when you're acting in a scene. Because, like, we'd do a take and I'd run and deal with something.
I mean, I never knew how you did it because, yeah, on the post side, we have deadlines we have to meet. I need you to approve visual effects shots. But you're on set, you know, directing mm-hmm. and acting. It's like, how do you have time to do all that? But you made it happen. Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I was actually talking to someone this morning who was a writer on the show, sort of, you know, going over what the experience was like for her and where it was difficult and where, you know, where, yeah, basically. And she said that it felt like, because I was saying, like, I couldn't really care for other people during the, like, I couldn't be a caretaker during the whole process. And she said, it felt like you were like an Olympic athlete who just had to get it done. Like there was such a focus during it, like everything else went away, you know, which isn't how it has to be always, but it had to be that way this time because of our schedule.
Why did you feel like you had to be a caretaker?
Well, she was talking about that she wanted to maybe like come to set more, but didn't know if it was okay and was afraid to text me. And I'm like, you definitely could have come. I was like, I couldn't be thinking about you because mm-hmm. I just was
you,
like,
had there's to get only so many things you can think about.
Yeah. And she got it, you know, but it was the type, like she was learning too. And so, and it was my first time doing this. Yeah. There, I mean, you're making a show, but you're also, there's like hundreds of personalities dealing with too. And so part of it is managing in that way.
What was your favorite role you played?
Directing. A million times over. Yeah, it's so fun and thrilling and the most creative. And it feels where I can be, except maybe when I'm like in the true flow of a scene, you know, with like Rosie or something, but where I can am the most intuitive,
mm-hmm.
which feels so gratifying because you're like, okay, I'm going in and what feels right and let's you know, structure the scene from something out of nothing.
What I also thought was so great about working on Smilf was the group of people that you put together. And I know you touched on it before. We had a really, really great, great crew.
Yes.
You hired a lot of minorities. I know you made a strong effort for that, which mm-hmm. was amazing. But also, everyone was smart, nice, and really good at their job, which is so rare. And it felt like a family. Like, we'd go to production meetings, and everyone, like, knows each other, which, again, like, isn't something I've experienced a lot.
Yeah, but that's also just, like, I don't know if this is because I grew up, like, alone a lot, that when I am, like, I always want people over my house. Like, I just, like, am, like, a collector, you know, and I want the family feeling, so.
And you're such a warm person.
But it's, like, it's important to me that, yeah, that we have that, or because I've also worked on sets as an actress where it's, you know, maybe colder, more clinical or something, and which is fine too. It's, you can go and do your job, leave, and that's fine. But the warmth is important of a feeling, but also like not at the expense of doing well or getting, like, what was great is that everyone was treating this job like it was their own, and they really cared about their work, and everyone was doing such amazing work, and so, and we were all talking to each other, you know, it wasn't like one, like, my costume designer was talking to my production designer constantly, mm-hmm. to building a world, and that there was this cohesiveness, and, And our A camera operator felt like she was empowered to go with her intuition and wasn't just beholden to, oh no, what am I doing exactly what the DP wants? And so then she would come up with these like miracle shots, you know, and you're like, oh, that's brilliant. And everyone sort of was feeding off each other in that way.
And that's also important because you're spread so thin that you can't be involved in every single aspect of it. So it's important that the crew was communicating with each other. So, yeah. But I also think it stems from the top. You know, if you're show running the show, you hire all the department heads. So it stems from you and hiring really good people. And then you get a successful show out of it.
I mean, I met with so many department heads, like when we were starting, it was very important that we found the right people for this, because it's the same thing I was saying when I'm meeting with writers, like there's so many talented people out there, but not everyone's right for every job.
Right. The other thing that I find really special about Smilf was the timeliness that it came out, because the Harvey Weinstein story started coming out right as the show was premiering.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think that you were writing the show in parallel to what was happening, but really you wrote it in June before it came out.
Right.
What was your take on everything that was happening?
Our show became part of the movement. You know, we were speaking the same language, and we were so fortunate that journalists that were covering our show were also covering people coming out with their stories. So there was this direct parallel that what was happening in the zeitgeist, it was all connected. And so, I was like, wow, this is incredible. The timing of it is
It was incredible.
Unreal.
Yeah. Especially episode 3, which touches on sexual abuse.
Yeah. And 8. And 1 and brings 8, it up.
Right. I mean, all over the board. Yeah. But I remember when that episode came out, people were like, oh my God, did she write this for the movement that's happening? And you're like, no.
There's no way. Yeah.
No. I mean, it was so meant to be. And I think you put that really well, that our show was part of the movement. Mm-hmm. Like, that's really true in a way.
Yeah, for sure. Yep. It's really cool. I remember when one of our Showtime executives was watching a cut of episode 3 the same day she had read the Harvey article. And she was like, it was so emotional, you know, because it was so, yeah. I mean, anomaly. It's this time in history when people are having these conversations. One of the only times. I mean, we talked about it a little bit during Anita Hill. Like, there's been these, like, but however, over, what was that, like, 17 years, however many years ago that was, 27, whatever. And so it's not often that we're having these cultural conversations at this level.
And episode 8 took a big dig at Woody Allen, and I saw Dylan Farrow reached out to you on Twitter.
She did.
What did that mean to you?
I was like, if we don't get to make one more episode, like, if we didn't get one fan, this was why.
That was so powerful, because I saw you tweet back to her, and I was like, wow. Like, you probably didn't even intend for that to happen.
No.
Did you think she would even see it?
No. I got the chills just thinking about it. No, that was so cool. Yeah, I really have a hard time on social media, because it just takes up so much energy and time, and then I'm always about to quit, but I'm like, but I should stay on, because I do want to stay in touch the fans. And then you get a tweet like that, and you're like, oh, this is the highest good, you know, that you can get from being on social media.
Definitely. What are your future goals with Smilf or with other projects that you want to make?
You know, for this next season, I want to get deeper into the supporting characters. I want to continue exploring the themes and topics that we started with. I feel like, you know, there's such little real estate in these 8 episodes, so just getting deeper. And then in general, it's just finding interesting projects to get behind as a director, as a writer, as a producer.
Would you direct projects that you don't write?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, no matter what, when you're directing, you bring in your own writing to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual writing process is... I have such bad ADD. Like, you can ask Zach, I spread out, I'm horizontal, books and papers everywhere. It takes me so long to get in it and out of it and in it. And it's just, it's a different process for me. I'm really better when I'm with people, you know, and then I go and I you have to do it and get into the hole and write, but it's definitely not, I mean, the thrill of after writing something, like after writing the scene in episode 3, for example, with the guy in the supermarket, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, so proud. You know, I'm like, oh, that is writing I'm proud of. But it's just so painstaking, you know, whereas, you know, at least my ADD brain works so much better when I'm directing. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, at least you know it works for you.
Yeah.
What type of artists are you inspired by?
What do you mean, what type? Like who? Or,
yeah, who?
I'm just watching this show now that I'm obsessed with called The End of the Fucking World on Netflix. It's so good. I love the filmmaking. It's such beautiful filmmaking and storytelling. You know, and then all of my favorite directors that I want to hang out with, like Steven Soderbergh and, you know. So just people who are honest to their vision. And it's such a subjective thing, what you respond to, you know.
Do you remember the first movie you saw that made you think, I want to be a director?
Yeah, because I didn't know that I could be a director until later. I saw a movie called Somersault by this Australian director named Kate Shortland that I was obsessed with. Then I saw Sweetie by Jane Campion, and I saw Woman Under the Influence when I worked at Kim's Video in New York. And those three movies were very important to me as an artist. Yeah.
Very cool. Now, on a less serious topic, what happened to your character on Mr. Robot?
Oh, I know.
I know, like, all fans, like, want to know that.
I want to clarify that she was always going to die.
Did you know that?
Yeah, I did know that. I mean, originally, the character was nothing, and it was just going to be a few episodes. And then we had so much fun on the pilot, and Rami and I connected so well, and Sam ended up writing this arc for her, knowing that it was going to be she was going to serve this purpose as the one person that Rami connected with on a human level, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I knew that, and
it was so devastating for fans, though.
I know.
Like, I watched the show before I met you, and I remember that feeling of like, what? Like, how could they do that?
That's why Sam is such a genius.
Oh my gosh, just the shock value.
I know. It was so fun to hear. It was my first time ever hearing from fans of anything, you know, and so it was so cool to hear people's reaction. Actually, Christian Slater at the table read of the show, you know, normally it was so funny because you're, as an actor, supposed to read the script before the table read, you know, but a lot of times you don't. You just show up. And so we were reading that episode and Christian hadn't read it and he was like, what? No! You know, and it was so funny because then he was like, oh, I should have known, you know. Just kidding, I've read it. But yeah, anyway, so.
Yeah. So that wasn't discouraging to you knowing that your character was going to die? Like, you still were excited about the experience?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, no one knew what that show was going to become. Mm-hmm. We were just like, oh, going to New York to do this strange little USA show, you know? Like, and the pilot looked so cool.
Yeah.
Like, okay, and then it became this sort of phenomenon that year.
Any fun stories from the Globes? Because the Globes were a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, the Globes were so
fun. How was it?
It was incredible. I mean, I was really, like, I had this, you know, you have to prepare a speech just in case.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. I spent so many hours.
Like, is that when the ADD brain comes in?
No, that's the other brain. That's okay. When it's like you don't do anything else but that. Mm. So, I mean, I was making my family crazy because I was just every day rewriting, sending my assistant Ellen. I was like, print this one out. Oh, no, print this one out. Just like constantly doing it. So I was just focused on that. And then when we did, when I could relax and enjoy it. And then when Oprah spoke, it was everything. She said everything better than anyone could have said it. And so I leaned over to the cast, like, oh, just, this is why we're here, to be in the presence of this speech. And so it was pretty incredible.
You know, the camera cut to you during her speech.
Someone texted me the photo.
And your hands were on your chin, and you were so engaged. I mean, it was so powerful. And I was like, she just must be.
It was amazing. You know what's so funny is that someone sent me the photo, and Zach, who's sitting next to me, is looking off. And he's looking at the monitor with the words at the speech.
He's reading the speech?
But it looks like he's just like, I'm not interested. He's just like spacing off into the distance. So funny.
So funny. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Yeah.
And it was so great talking to you. And I just loved working with you. It was just such an incredible experience.
Thank you. Same.
As a woman, you know, it's so empowering and inspiring to see other young women just go after their dreams and have success. So thank you for being a role model for so many people.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that's the show, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Inside the Artist. New episodes will be out every 2 weeks, so every second Wednesday. I have a lot of amazing artists lined up. I have bands, I have session musicians, actors, writers, showrunners, comedians. You'll hear from some amazing people. So hit that subscribe button and stay tuned for more episodes of Inside the Artist.